Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at ThomisticInstitute.org.
Over the course of my academic career, I have maintained that Christian humanism holds the radical middle between extremes that are not friendly to literary culture. But of course, you have not suffered the misfortune of accompanying me on my academic career. And since that is the case, some explanation of my terms is probably in order. To begin then, what is this mysterious entity called Christian humanism? It's important to note the word humanism wasn't used during the Renaissance. It was invented in the 19th century and used in various competing ways. If we take the word to refer to work done by scholars during the Renaissance, especially those who pursued a grand synthesis of classical and modern knowledge, we are on solid ground, or at least we are not at sea. We have something to build on. The later term, Christian humanism, admits of the same historical considerations. Its usages vary across disciplines. Like humanism itself, its scope and variety resist the effort to corral it inside the bounds of a single definition. Having no such definition in hand, I can do no better than to present Christian humanism as an interpretive framework and a work in progress. I apply it to Christian authors whose historical consciousness reaches back to the ancients and whose work crosses sectarian boundaries. I do not automatically consider a contemporary Christian or Catholic writer to be a Christian humanist. Such writers may appeal to Catholics or to Protestants or both, but unless a Christian author can appeal to non-Christian readers, he or she is too sectarian to meet my requirements. In the case of Shakespeare, his Christianity is more often doubted than his broad appeal. I take the flip side of the argument. His broad appeal is based on his Christianity. Whether we have in mind his handling of pagan ideas or his attention to late-breaking developments in theology and natural science, Shakespeare assimilates his knowledge and experience to a biblical perspective. He is the most biblical of the great Elizabethan playwrights. And so, by studying how he fuses Christian ideas and meanings with non-Christian ideas and meanings, I present Shakespeare's Christian humanism as an effort at imaginative synthesis that varies from play to play. Fortunately, the topic of Shakespeare and religion has established itself within the vast historical field of Shakespeare criticism. The best books and essays on this topic bring a seriousness of purpose and a depth of learning that render any glib assumptions about Shakespeare and religion obsolete. And yet, a Christian Shakespeare remains to some either anathema or so intellectually distant that party lines inevitably emerge. We find ourselves on contentious and difficult ground. For that reason, I want to make an appeal to good pragmatic standards. Accordingly, I propose that if the study of Shakespeare as a Christian humanist affords us a high degree of explanatory power, otherwise unavailable, if it compels our understanding through its historical consistency and respect for fact, then we must admit its validity in the name of good critical practice, whether we like Christianity or not. The same could be said, for example, of the best feminist criticism. As a Christian humanist, I argue that Shakespeare is a Christian writer who criticizes and challenges Christians, but who uses Christian means to do so. He exploits artistic resources and possibilities that are specific to Christianity. This argument puts me at loggerheads with numerous high-ranking scholars, such as Harvard's Stephen Greenblatt, who has this to say on the topic of Shakespeare and religion, quote, "His work suggests that he did have faith of a sort, but it was not a faith securely bound either by the Catholic Church or by the Church of England. By the late 1590s, insofar as his faith could be situated in any institution at all, that institution was the theater," end quote. Like other intelligent secularists, Greenblatt advances a view of religion and literature that separates them into discrete modes of discourse, with reference in this case to the church and the theater. I do not deny that Greenblatt is a highly resourceful scholar of early modern literature who has elevated the topic among Shakespeareans. I am observing that his method is to toggle between religion and literature rather than to explore the depth of their coherence. It is this coherence, which is unsystematic, ad hoc, differing from play to play, that commands our attention. At the same time, while advancing our Christian humanist perspective, we must recognize, as the late Paul Cantor asks us to do, that any, quote, investigation of the phenomenon of Christian humanism ought to begin with a frank admission of how deeply problematic the concept is, of how many tensions and contradictions lie concealed beneath what appears to be a simple label, end quote. Cantor is absolutely right. Again, one can see how difficult it is to fuse Christianity and classicism, he observes. The Achilles of Homer's Iliad is the classical hero par excellence, and it would be hard to imagine a less Christian figure. This comment overlooks the vengeful prophecies of the book of Revelation, where Christ himself wields a sharp sword, chapter 19, verse 15. But the point is well taken. For Cantor, quote, attempts at arriving at a higher synthesis of antithetical values can end up highlighting the conflicts between them, end quote. No doubt this is true. Where my emphasis differs from Cantor is in my concern for Shakespeare's attention to the conflict, preeminent in Hamlet, between antithetical values. To the extent that Hamlet's psyche is never fully integrated, to the extent that it suffers imbalances and disorders, it reflects the disintegration of Christendom, which, as the antithetical values of the Reformation and the Counter-Reformation would suggest, had entered a state of war. One might ask, how well did truth survive the tensions and contradictions that Cantor refers to? Its authority, as Augustine conceived it, diminished. Its abstract power as that through which dialectic is true declined. Scholar Jeffrey Shepard's insight into the humanist agenda is apt. Humanists believe that truth, by virtue of its nature, requires exemplification and finds its confirmation only in the complexity of existence. Truth, so understood, was primarily moral, not scientific in our contemporary sense, which distinguishes fact from value. Finding truth in the complexity of human experience, Shakespeare brings to life the central tensions and contradictions of his society. In Shakespeare's Christian humanism, the higher synthesis of Hellenism and Hebraism, of Athens and Jerusalem, is never systematic, but it could nonetheless bring truth into play. This synthesis became a means of assimilating and addressing the great issues of a changing world, from theology to the arts, from law to politics, from the economies of market towns to the challenges of international trade, from the teachings of Aristotle to the incursions of natural philosophy, from the power of the Virgin Queen to the role of women in society. In the adaptability of its construction materials, Shakespeare's imaginative synthesis served as a bridge to the past, including folkways that it altered at a touch. It was never more exacting for an audience than when Shakespeare connected the Delphic imperative, know thyself, a humanist commonplace, to the constant cause for doing so, namely, the reality of judgment. You wanted to know yourself because you were going to be judged. Shakespeare's assimilation of salvation history and classical lore to the realities of contemporary life must have amounted for Elizabethan theatergoers to an intensely entertaining pedagogical and moral experience, which I suggest is practically the whole point of Shakespeare's art. He was, after all, an entertainer. I turn now to my second term, the radical middle, which I owe in part to John Henry Newman's idea of a university. Has anybody read Newman's idea of a university here? People know the work? It's a good one. You may recall that Newman locates the university as a self-governing institution in between the church, Catholic Church, and the secular research academies. The University for Newman is not responsible for evangelizing or forming a Christian conscience. Its orientation to the facts of the modern world gives it a humanistic opening, not an evangelical imperative. Building on Newman's outline of a liminal space between the sacred and the secular, while also drawing on the cultural writings of T.S. Eliot, for whom culture is an outgrowth of religion, I invented a term, the radical middle, that is not in Newman or Eliot. I suggest that in Shakespeare's time, the radical middle flourished in the cultural opening between two powerful censors. On the one hand, the master of revels, and on the other, the anti-theatrical writers, represented most notoriously by clergyman Stephen Gosson. The Elizabethan state authorized the master of revels to protect its political interests by censoring and redacting plays. Gosson and his fellow Christian moralists, who included Catholics, Protestants, and Puritans, denounced the popular stage for reasons both religious and practical. Shakespeare was doubtless aware of them. A playwright had to keep an eye out for trouble. The radical middle was and remains a site of cultural originality, as expressed through mimetic works of art that speak to a broad audience. It describes the conceptual space where Shakespeare was free to engage provocative questions of theology and politics, and where his Christian skepticism could serve his literary purposes. We should not forget that Shakespeare was heir to the skepticism of Erasmus and Thomas More, and to the Christian Pyrrhonism of Montaigne. I am not suggesting that his skepticism towards systematic thinking, whether it be scholastic or political, was a form of sophistry. Like the Delphic command, "Know thyself," Shakespeare's Christian skepticism pushed his audience to ask serious questions that appealed to their cosmic minds. He did not instruct them didactically, like the modern day propagandist instructing us in groupthink. And if he preferred to entertain multiple perspectives than to promote a moral lesson or a single transcendent truth, it was to highlight the limits of human knowledge, not to deny that morality and truth exist. As I have suggested, Christian humanism is a critical practice. It makes, if you will, for a good conversation. To demonstrate the practice of Christian humanism, I will discuss two plays, Julius Caesar, first performed in 1599, and Hamlet, first performed in 1602. Some of you know Hamlet. All right, Julius Caesar, anybody? Oh, fantastic. The compositional history of these works is largely unknown, and it may be that for a few overlapping months toward the end of the 16th century, both occupied a place on Shakespeare's writing desk. Thematically, both works reflect Shakespeare's preoccupation with our tragic ignorance regarding the fate of the soul. Let us begin, then, by turning our attention to Julius Caesar. Brutus's soliloquy at the start of Act II is a study in self-evasion. It has the Augustinian potential, qua soliloquy, to be a form of colloquium with God. It was the English scholar Brian Cummings who pointed out that the Augustine idea of the soliloquy, that it was always spoken in the company of God, was still operative in the Elizabethan period. So it makes us rethink the solus, the alone quality of Hamlet's soliloquies and the other great soliloquies we hear during this period. Shakespeare's Brutus, a pagan speaking before a Christian audience, is unaware of their God. This is why I point to the rhetorical tradition of Augustine. Shakespeare's audience is so keenly aware of the Christian God that it supplies the Christian conscience deficient in the speaker. We cannot understand the play if we disregard its most basic rhetorical situation. The dramatic irony of the audience's understanding the character's real moral position better than they do. Alone in his orchard, Brutus has Caesar on his mind. And since the quarrel will bear no color for the thing he is, fashion it thus, that what he is augmented would run to these and these extremities. And therefore, think him as the serpent's egg, which hatched, would, as his kind, grow mischievous and kill him in his shell. The quarrel is, of course, the case against Caesar. Brutus suspects that Caesar's murder will be a tough sell to the commoners because the conspirators lack a legitimate reason for carrying it out. To get what he really wants, Brutus has recourse neither to conscience nor to reason, but to his will. Fashion it thus. He projects what Christians would recognize as his own sins of pride and envy onto a serpent's egg of his own imagination, the serpent being emblematic in the Elizabethan mind of Satan in the Garden of Eden. That is why we are in Brutus's orchard, with no one bearing witness except Brutus himself, the audience, and their God. Brutus's stoical mind defers to an ethos of heroic competition between aristocratic, honor-driven males. Brutus is not delayed by an internal lawgiver. Lacking a Christian conscience, he is unable to know himself at his moment of crisis. Let me underscore what I am calling the play's most basic rhetorical situation: the dramatic irony of the audience's understanding the character's real moral position better than they do. The Christians watching the play are well equipped to judge the moral state of these noble Romans. The dialogue begins, I'm moving now to the very beginning of the play. The dialogue begins as the tribune Flavius interrogates a common laborer about who he is. The laborer, answering Flavius, says simply, "Why, sir, a carpenter." In my view, this brief reply is enough to evoke a crucial reference point, namely, the historical neighborhood of the most famous carpenter of all time. Next up is a cobbler who develops the Christian counterpoint. The cobbler is a clown, a scene stealer whose theological wit looks forward to the gravediggers in Hamlet. The tribune Marullus berates him. "What trade art thou? Answer me directly." The cobbler replies, "A trade, sir, that I may use with a safe conscience, which is indeed, sir, a mender of bad souls." These lines pack a punch. As regards the phrase safe conscience, the adjective safe means mentally or morally sound. As regards conscience, it occurs only here in the entire play, the only usage of the word conscience. Very first scene. It is the most deliberately Christian touch in the scene. It sets up a contrast with the Romans, who do not act according to a Christian conscience. The cobbler identifies himself with a pun, what students today might call a dad joke. He calls himself a mender of bad souls. Clearly, Shakespeare's cobbler wants to satisfy a Christian conscience. Now, about that pun. If the verbal play on souls sails right over the heads of the tribunes Marullus and Flavius, the joke is on them. The Elizabethans knew better. "What meanst thou by that? Mend me, thou saucy fellow," replies Marullus to the mender of bad souls. The verb to mend conveys the spiritual suggestion of to free a person, character, habits, etc., from sin or fault, to improve morally, to reform. This meaning is not infrequent in Shakespeare. In Julius Caesar, the spiritual suggestion of mend works alongside souls as a Christian pun. Its reclamation is a matter of theological sensitivity. If we lose the resonance of Christian mending, we also lose the pointed incomprehension of Marullus. Worst of all, we fail to recognize the dramatic irony of the audience's understanding the character's real moral position better than they do. As greatly as they loom in the annals of history, Shakespeare's noble Romans are, by an ironic species of inverse proportion, extremely deficient in self-knowledge. Brutus's problem is like Hamlet's. Neither of these highly intelligent men understands how he stands in relation to God, though Hamlet is much more aware of this problem. At the same time, their ambiguous situation infects the audience, for since we cannot readily discern hero from villain, we find ourselves lacking in self-knowledge as well. We are implicated in the play of judgment. When he begins to take Cassius's bait, Brutus looks foolishly without, not within himself. In moral terms, his honor is purely public. "But wherefore do you hold me here so long? What is it that you would impart to me? If it be aught toward the general good, set honor in one eye and death in the other, and I will look on both indifferently. For let the gods so speed me as I love the name of honor more than I fear death. It is a sad moment, this solemn idolatry of honor, this self-righteous creed of a pagan Hotspur. I am reminded of a comment by G.K. Chesterton. One of the strange marks of the strength of Christianity is that, since it came, no pagan in our civilization has been able to be really human. This kind of insight, Nietzschean in its tartness, but Christian in its philosophy, would normally be shouted down. But here we can speculate. Brutus cannot be really human because he can reckon with himself only in the field of competition and action. He lacks the power of soul to integrate his interbeing with his public life. Most telling of all, his love is misdirected. He loves the name of honor as if it were his own. He idolizes his ideal self-image. Julius Caesar is a study in misinterpretation, and Cassius is another who would bend reality to his will. As an Epicurean, he does not credit things that do presage. He spurns belief in portents because the gods are indifferent to human affairs. Nonetheless, he plays off others' religious fears. He does so when he encounters Casca during the tempest of Act 1, Scene 3, and he continues to manipulate Casca, who will join the conspiracy, by appealing to the Stoic approval of suicide as a response to tyrannical abuse. Cassius from bondage will deliver Cassius. Therein, ye gods, you make the weak most strong. Therein, ye gods, you tyrants do defeat. Remember that Cassius will in fact commit suicide on his birthday at Philippi. Misinterpreting his servant's report, he takes his life in a fit of ignorance. His death violates the Christian canon against self-slaughter, and that is part of the play's complex emotional texture. The closing action, in which both Cassius and Brutus take their own lives, is blisteringly fast-paced, a pagan apocalypse where spectacle staggers the imagination. Augustine was the first church father to condemn suicide, and I have always wondered about Shakespeare's knowledge of Augustine. That Shakespeare's noble Romans inhabit the city of man in an Augustinian sense is an argument for a separate lecture. One thing I will say is that Shakespeare's Augustinian insights must be thoroughly ignored if we are to turn Julius Caesar into a laboratory for political science. The play is not a model of rational human behavior. For now, I will compare Cassius's brave words about suicide, which I have just read to you, to the words of St. Paul as he passed on the Lord's message to the church at Corinth. St. Paul. And he said unto me, my grace is sufficient for thee, for my power is made perfect through weakness. Very gladly, therefore, will I rejoice rather in mine infirmities, that the power of Christ may dwell in me. Therefore, I take pleasure in infirmities, in reproaches, in necessities, in persecutions, in anguish for Christ's sake. For when I am weak, then I am strong. Cassius and Paul both speak of inverting strength and weakness, but their meanings are antithetical. Cassius claims the power to deliver himself from bondage. Like Caesar, he asserts his authority by referring to himself in the third person. The Christian claims no such power. His only power is through Christ, and it is Christ's name we hear from Paul. From a Christian perspective, the political pagan is living in the shadowlands. The Christian has seen the light. And yet, it emerges in Acts 4 and 5 that Cassius's motives are not pure evil. His friendship with Brutus is not an act. Cassius is a pagan Machiavellian, but he bears a human heart that loves, however incompletely, and a mind that tries to make sense of things. He is like us too. He expands our sympathies beyond ourselves. Brutus's second brief soliloquy in the orchard, back at Act 2, Scene 1, reveals his exceptional intelligence. It is a fine point, the distinction between conscience and self-consciousness. But while Shakespeare denies Brutus the former, conscience, he grants him the latter, self-consciousness. Since Cassius first did whet me against Caesar, I have not slept. between the acting of a dreadful thing and the first motion. All the interim is like a phantasma or a hideous dream. The genius and the mortal instruments are then in council. The state of man, like to a little kingdom, suffers then the nature of an insurrection. According to C.S. Lewis, it was the Apostle Paul who propelled the meaning of conscience from its earlier sense of self-witness to its later sense of moral judgment. The cobbler uses the later sense in Act I. I think the distinction obtains here as well because, as we have seen, Brutus has no inner lawgiver. He is a tortured spectator of himself who makes up his mind on insufficient grounds. He cannot say with the God-haunted Hamlet that conscience makes cowards of us all. He suffers moral paralysis, and Cassius gives him a push. Shakespeare's critique of Stoicism coheres, I think, with his sense of Rome's historical crisis. Caesar is a competitive male Stoic who has far outperformed his rivals. He compares himself to the North Star, but despite his sublime constancy, he is deaf in one ear. He has the falling sickness, and he can be butchered like a calf. Remember that Cicero in De Officiis describes the proper Roman attitude as one of greatness of soul and a sense of superiority to worldly conditions. In Julius Caesar, this pagan greatness and superiority clash against pagan debilities. Stoicism has ironic limitations, and the world will soon find a rival paradigm of rectitude and Christian sanctity. We can assume that Shakespeare took note of this. As we have seen from the contrast between Cassius and St. Paul, Jesus and Julius demand very different forms of behavior. The supercharged word passion occurs 3 times in the play. It is a kind of kryptonite for these Stoic supermen. Brutus, in his first conversation with Cassius, speaks of being vexed with passions of some difference, conceptions only proper to myself. There is dignity in this utterance, but there is also bemusement. Cassius, sensing Brutus's perplexity, picks up on the word. "Then, Brutus, I have much mistook your passion." The word passion thus signifies a chink in Brutus's mental armor. It creates an opening for Cassius. Antony, the lover of plays, comes closest to understanding the word. When Octavius's servant weeps at the sight of Caesar's corpse, Antony comments, "Passion I see is catching, for mine eyes, seeing those beads of sorrow stand in thine, began to water." For early readers of the folio text, which is the only text we have of Julius Caesar's, the 1623 folio, the capital P that marks the start of the verse line, "Passion I see is catching," would have evoked the capital P Passion of Christ. Related to this contagion of passion is the so-called Poetry of Tears, a literary vogue associated with Jesuit poet and martyr Robert Southwell, whose posthumous work, St. Peter's Complaint, published in 1595, made a powerful impression at the time. One thinks also of the famous medieval hymn, Stabat Mater, with its tearful representation of Mary. My suggestion is that Shakespeare saw a sharp difference between Stoic apathy and Christian pathos. This is not to say that Mark Antony is parodying or participating in Christian passion. Antony's phrase, "passion is catching," is consistent with a cast of characters who keep reminding us of what they don't know. All of this reflects a society on the brink. It reminds us that Julius Caesar is a meditation on history if we understand what history meant to Shakespeare. The Elizabethans were greatly influenced by biblical notions of type and antitype. They inhabited a biblical cosmos in which sacred history stood behind current events. The Bible took notice of the Caesars, who therefore presented a rich opportunity for pondering the links between the secular and the sacred. Plutarch, likewise, with his literary interest in the lives of great men, enabled a Christian writer to ponder how secular and sacred history intersected in the world of ancient Rome. That Plutarch's noble Romans participate in the same moral and spiritual patterns that underlay Shakespeare's English history plays was inevitable given the Elizabethan world picture. Most important, it was Shakespeare's perception of historical irony, his technique for handling what the Romans did not know, that created parallels between Rome and London. In taking the measure of Brutus, Shakespeare took the measure of history itself and found it wanting. History may have been written by the winners, but it was acted by Roman and English fools. As we turn from Julius Caesar to Hamlet, let us keep our eye on the bridge between the two plays, which is Shakespeare's preoccupation with our tragic ignorance regarding the fate of the soul. The question I put before you is, how and to what degree is Hamlet less ignorant than Brutus? How and to what degree is Hamlet less ignorant than Brutus? In Act 5, Scene 2, we find Hamlet and Horatio deep in conversation. We are not far removed from the conversational intimacy of Brutus and Cassius, especially given Horatio's stoical inclinations. Like Brutus in his second soliloquy in the orchard, Hamlet describes a battle within his soul. This precedes an account of his robbing Rosencrantz and Guildenstern of the Grand Commission they carry from Denmark to England. So here's the Hamlet of Act 5, Scene 2, talking to Horatio. "Sir, in my heart there was a kind of fighting that would not let me sleep. Methought I lay worse than the mutins and the bilboes. Rashly, and praise be rashness for it, let us know our indiscretion sometimes serves us well when our deep plot do pull. And that should learn us, there's a divinity that shapes our ends, rough you them how we will." Horatio, "That is most certain." Hamlet, "Up from my cabin, my sea gown scarfed about me, in the dark groped I to find out them, had my desire, fingered their packet, and in fine withdrew to mine own room again, making so bold, my fears forgetting manners, to unseal their grand commission, where I found Horatio, ah, royal knavery, an exact command, larded with many several sorts of reasons, importing Denmark's health and England's too, with ho, such bugs and goblins in my life, that on the supervise, no leisure baited, no, not to stay the grinding of the axe, my head should be cut off." If Hamlet is in better shape than Brutus, it is because he views the potential failure of our deep plots in terms of spiritual bondage. He is humbler than Brutus, and his experience verges on the mystical, the word methought, as in Bottom's dream. Play, Bottom's dream? Midsummer Night's Dream? All right, well, good. The word methought, as in Bottom's dream, was used among the Elizabethans to signal a dream or vision. Here, the dreamlike quality of experience receives metrical emphasis from the inverted phrase referring to Rosencrantz and Guildenstern, "groped I to find out them." Hamlet is groping like a blind man in the dark. Rosencrantz and Guildenstern are even further in the dark, without a glimmer of conscience or self-consciousness. They are worse off spiritually than the pagan Brutus. Hamlet's heightened sensitivity to freedom and bondage, the topic of much Reformation controversy, really the very basis, the foundation of Reformation controversy, informs the metaphor and image of the mutins in the bilboes, the mutineers in chains. This spiritual complex attracts Shakespeare's pen, as Hamlet pauses his narration to pass judgment on himself, to approve his rashness and indiscretion, spurring sententious talk of free will and predestination. "There's a divinity shapes our ends, rough hew them how we will." The Stoic Horatio assents in what appears to readers of the play as a stepped line. "Rough hew them how we will, that is most certain." If Hamlet and Horatio are doing the talking, the stepped line helps us sense an author who is shaping their fates, writing and revising, conceiving the ends of a most difficult play. Hamlet's narration has taken us back aboard the Danish ship headed for England on the day before the pirates attacked and held him for ransom. He wakes from spiritual bondage to the liberating impulse of "up from my cabin," which floats above the gravity of meter. Up he rose, his sea gown scarfed about him, as if further concealing himself from view, though we are already in the dark. The immediate effect is one of blindness groping its way through narrow constraints of meter and syntax. But, as the psalmist reminds us in praising the Lord, "Yea, the darkness hideth not from thee, but the night shineth as the day. Hamlet, it follows biblically, is describing his route of providential deliverance through a divine darkness that outshines the shadow realm of appearances. I come now to the topic of fate and providence and to the difference between the veiled nature of providence in Julius Caesar and its accessibility to intuition in Hamlet. We have been considering Hamlet's providential reading of his own story. There is a divinity shapes our ends, rough you them how we will. Either these verses are justified, as Hamlet would justify his own actions. Either these verses connect thematically to the larger play, or else the maker does not know his ends. Handing Horatio the original commission, evidently the pirates allowed him to keep it, Hamlet explains to his friend, "Ere I could make a prologue to my brains, they had begun the play." It sounds like automatic writing. From the histrionic, that means referring to actors in the stage, from the histrionic metaphor of prologue and play, Hamlet turns Horatio's attention to the benefits of his fair handwriting, which does him yeoman service. For an Elizabethan audience, he would have been taken as referring to a type of handwriting known as secretary hand. The Shakespearean fragment from the manuscript of Sir Thomas More, known as Hand D, is written in secretary hand. That's the only surviving fragment we have of Shakespeare's own handwriting, and it's in this type of handwriting, secretary hand. It was naturally the preferred handwriting of forgers, and when William Henry Ireland took to forging Shakespeare documents in the 18th century, secretary hand is what he used. Hamlet's automatic writing is done in secretary hand. Well then, whose secretary is he? I will leave the question hanging. Shakespeare concentrates our attention not only on how Hamlet writes, but on what he writes. The word comma happens twice in Shakespeare. Once is in Hamlet, when the prince describes the revised commission in his own hand. An earnest conjuration from the king, as England was his faithful tributary, as love between them like a palm might flourish, as peace should still her wheaten garland wear, and stand a comma between their amities and money such like asses of great charge, etc. Shakespeare not only has Hamlet writing, he has Hamlet writing about the act of writing, the handwriting and the automatic writing by which he makes a prologue to what he calls the play, which marks yet another play within the play. This self-referentiality in 3,900 odd lines that gallop through verse, prose, drama, letters, philosophy, legal documents, references to records, tables, and whatnot, is what makes Hamlet the play seem like a thinking organism aware of itself. We might say that the character Hamlet touches on the form of all these forms of writing when he promises in Act 1, Scene 5, that the ghost's commandment will live within the book and volume of my brain, unmixed with baser matter. It is an example of the rhetorical figure Hendiadys, one of many in a play that repeatedly draws attention to its own compositional choices, not the voluminous book of his brain, but the book and volume of his brain. Brutus, who is reading a book when Caesar's ghost first visits him in his tent, falls short of this introspective weight, this introspective volume. In Julius Caesar, Shakespeare deploys a pre-biblical arrangement of alphabets, words, epistles, and testaments to foreshadow the revelation of the word. After all, the Greek and Latin languages bear a special relation to providential history. But Brutus does not possess the book of books, the Bible, and this lack defines him. It is the mysterious source of his tragic ignorance. We forget it was through Christianity, as Ernest Robert Curtius reminds us, quoting Curtius now, that the book received its highest consecration. Christ is the only God whom antique art represents with a book scroll. In his landmark work of scholarship, European Literature in the Latin Middle Ages, Curtius collects a long catalog of book metaphors from the Bible and the lives of the saints. He indexes the book of beauty, the book of the creature, the book of experience, the book of fate, the book of the future, the book of God, the book of the heart, the book of the heavens, the book of history, the book of life, the book of love, the book of memory, the book of the mind, the book of nature, the book of reason, the book of the soul, and the book of time. By way of courteous again, here are three scriptural instances that, because they conceive of the biblical God as an author, cast light on Hamlet. First, quote, "The tables of the law are written with the finger of God," Exodus chapter 31, verse 18. You will recall Hamlet's odd reference to his writing tablet as tables at 1:5-1:08. Second, the psalmist begins a festal song with the words, "My tongue is the pen of a ready writer." That is to say that David, the inspired author of the Psalms, was God's secretary. Third, in the book of Revelation, books reveal the soul's fate in eternity. The powerful authority of books, as perfected in the Bible, informs Hamlet's career from the opening lines of his first soliloquy, where God's canon against self-slaughter evokes the biblical canon, the collection or list of books accepted by the Christian church as genuine and inspired. It continues with the murder of Gonzago, into which Hamlet inserts a dozen or 16 lines. Most strangely of all, it touches the forged document that sends Rosencrantz and Guildenstern to their death. "How was this sealed?" asks Horatio about the newly forged commission. "Why," replies Hamlet, "even in that heaven ordinant." In other words, the dirty trick he plays on his former schoolfellows is justified in Hamlet's eyes by providence. It is not on Hamlet's conscience. Heaven stands behind it. But while the Lord may have chiseled the Decalogue with his finger, or dictated the Psalms to David, or authored the books and scrolls in the book of Revelation, we may nonetheless think to ourselves, what is providence's role in forging grand commissions? Can truth do business with a forgery? Would God permit such means? Before stiffening to a conclusion about Shakespeare and the mystery of providence, I want briefly to reiterate my point about his skepticism. I won't pursue the impact of Montaigne on Hamlet, but let Montaigne serve for a moment as an intellectual port of call for both Christianity and skepticism. In other words, Shakespeare's Christian skepticism is not alien to the Christian Europe of his time. Like Montaigne, Hamlet is more than capable of asking, "Que sais-je? What do I know?" Recalling his Bible, he allays Horatio's concerns. There is special providence in the fall of a sparrow. This final movement towards resolution comes not through human wisdom in a pagan sense, but through Christian wisdom about human folly. As St. Paul said or warned us, the wisdom of God is folly in the eyes of the world, and the wisdom of the world is folly in the eyes of God. Shakespeare was intensely conscious of this paradox. It is the pivot on which his highest thinking turns. For Hamlet, we are, after all, fools of nature. He wonders aloud in the presence of the ghost, "What may this mean that thou, dead corpse, again in complete steel, revisits thus the glimpses of the moon, making night hideous, and we fools of nature so horridly to shake our disposition with thoughts beyond the reaches of our souls?" To the Elizabethans, it was obvious there are thoughts beyond the reaches of our souls, more particularly within certain strains of Christian theology, which took on a life of their own during the Reformation. Thoughts beyond the reaches of our souls weigh infinitely more than the plots we think we can master. But like the Elizabethans, and unlike the noble Romans of Julius Caesar, Hamlet knows 'tis the sport to have the engineer hoist with his own petard. The petard is the bomb. 'Tis the sport to have the engineer hoist with his own bomb. Beware of being too confident in your plots, that is to say. Hamlet is not saved by his conscience, which fails him in his ordeal. He is saved, if he is saved, by the self-consciousness by which he sees himself as a fool. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith. and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.